Welcome to this OCCT, Oxford Graduate Criticism and Translation event. If you don't know us or part of our group, please go to our website and kind of sign up, and then you will get news of other similarly brilliant, well, not sure if they'll be quite as brilliant as this one is going to be, but similarly interesting and exciting events in the future. That's www.occ.ac.uk. And my name is Matthew Reynolds. And it's my huge pleasure to introduce our three speakers here this evening. Two of whom will be known to many of you, Abigail Trimble, who's in classics at Trinity and has been working on Catullus 64 for a little while.
Yeah.
But first as your doctoral work and now preparing a major edition of it. Nicola Gardini in Italian, enviably. Scarily kind of productive colleague in many genres, scholarship, especially in the Renaissance and also fiction and also poetry. The most recent, I'm not sure how many books have come out in this last year, but the book that came out a couple of months ago is called Lacuna Saggio sul non detto, kind of essay on the unsaid, which seemed to me, when I first thought about it, was a kind of really counterintuitive thing for Nicola to be writing about, given that he produces so much and so imaginatively. But on the other hand, there's a kind of sense in taking the sort of filling the topic of emptiness. And then also, what are we talking about this evening, which is this translation of, where is the copy of this translation of Catullo into Italian, which came out a couple of months ago. And finally, Joe Barmer, who's come to us from some distance, whose translation, whose sort of versions, and reworkings and personal imaginative engagement with Catullus is in these two books, which are from a few years ago now, but which are kind of very vivid and lasting engagements, and she's returned to the topic of translation and Catullus and other kinds of translation in a more scholarly, partly self-expository but also self-reflective but also scholarly mode in this really interesting book, Piecing Together the Fragments, which came out the year before last, I think, and is also available last year and is also available electronically now and is easy to read. So the idea of this session is to hear about different modes of response to and rewriting of Catullus from the more scholarly and expert, but not for that reason necessarily less imaginative, perhaps, through other kinds of no less expert, but perhaps bringing different kinds of expertise, kind of responses, different modes of translation. Nicola's translation is poetic, but is presented in parallel text, so it has sort of something of a scholarly air to it, at least in the way that it's presented and in its kind of accuracy. But at the same time, it has an urgency about it and wants to speak to the moment. Indeed, it's introduced with Nicola saying, "I've translated Catullus because I feel you can help us." So there's a kind of ambition of immediacy there. And Joe's kind of translating and rewriting, feminist answering back, updating, and sort of getting involved imaginatively in all sorts of different ways. So the feeling is that the idea would be that there's a kind of spectrum of responses, and we think about ways in which they overlap. A kind of epigraph to the session, to Joe's book from Anne Carson. My versions of Catullus bear about the same relationship to translation as Francis Bacon's paintings do to mugshots. He says they're very close, which is actually, I think, quite an interesting thing to think about. And that's the sort of question I hope we'll think about in the next little while. The idea is that our speakers will go one after another, and then we'll have a break and then we'll have a discussion. But if there are sort of urgent and precise questions you want to ask after each presentation, please do, points of clarification. Quite heard or understood. We thought we'd start with Gail and then Nicola and then Joe. Gail.
Thank you very much. So, as I'm going first, I thought I would do this sort of few second introduction to Catullus and what you would find between his covers. to anybody who doesn't know this. The important part of which is that he is an incredibly varied poet. He does not have a nice, neat book all in one genre, as so many ancient poets do. And what you will basically find is love poetry, invective or obscene poetry, and long and learned poetry. And the corpus, as it's transmitted to us, is basically in three parts. One set of shorter poems in mixed meters and very much mixed subject matter, could be almost anything. The longer ones, which tend to be the more learned ones, and the epigrammatic ones, which again have both love and invective in them and plenty of other things as well, but are quite different in style from the sort of shorter poems at the beginning of the corpus as well. I'm not going to talk any more about that in theory because some of that will come up in what I'm going to say in practice for the examples I'm going to use. I also wanted to say that as well as writing a very long and dense edition and commentary on Catullus 64, which is one of the long learned poems, I teach Catullus every year to first year undergraduates just as a literary study. And I've also been involved for the first time this year in teaching Catullus to finalists and master's level students as a test case for textual criticism. In all three of these sort of engagements, I'm somebody who very much works with the Latin. I'm trying to explain it, appreciate what Catullus is doing with it, come to a very in-depth understanding of the Latin itself. But I and my students are speakers of English. And in looking at the one example from each part of the corpus that I want to look at, I want to think a little bit about Catullus's Latin, Catullus's style, but also to show where and how translation plays a part in interpretation, both literary interpretation and textual editing, as we sort of try and produce a text that makes better sense. We sort of explain to each other, well, this is how you translate it if you read this word, and this is how you translate it if you read a different word. So, I mean, I am a Latinate person trying to improve my students and my readers and my own Latin, but this English translation explanation is essential to those processes. And one of the things that's most noticeable about those processes is the points of hesitation, the points where, for different reasons in different cases, it becomes difficult to translate, and that makes it difficult to interpret, to write commentary or to teach. So I'm going to start with a poem from the first part of the corpus, a more chatty conversational poem, which is set for this first year course that I teach. And I often set it for a collection, for an exam where I say, translate this for me to show you've understood it. And I read their versions and I discover whether they have in fact read it or not, and I also discover how they've dealt with some of the issues in it. As I say, it's from this first part of the corpus, and it's in a meter very typical of this part of the corpus, which is the hendecasyllable. Every line is the same rhythm, and it goes like this. O for optime balneariorum, qui benni pater et canide fili, nam dextra pater inquinatiore, culo filius est voraciore, cur non exilium malasque in oras itis. Quando quidem patris rapinae notae sunt populo, et natis pilosas fili non potes asse venditare. So I've set up the translation of that as a kind of mind map, because I wanted to show somehow the sort of thing that I and perhaps my students have in mind as we read the poem in Latin. It's meant to indicate the sort of mental translation of bits and pieces, drawing on, you know, Latin as you were taught it, that happens, I think, to an English speaker, and perhaps particularly somebody from a British educational context, trying to read and interpret the Latin. And perhaps is even what goes through my students' minds when I make them translate it. So they start off, are they going to include the O or not? It's very formal in English, whereas just typical in Latin. Can you capture the fact that vibenni could address the father and the son? What on earth do you do with this word kinidus? Explaining what that means needs a whole conversation, and possible translations, you know, there you are in your undergraduate exam, sort of hover uneasily around all these sort of offensive words for gays from various past eras that in which this word has sometimes been translated in published translations at all. And it's directed, it's almost always vocative in Catullus as it is here. It's a word you address at somebody to insult them. the main textual question of this poem that comes up during textual criticism is this word describing what the father's right hand is like. Inquinatiore just means more polluted, more defiled. And so people have thought, is that really specific enough? Is that what we want for a right hand characterised by being thieving? Could we describe it as uncinatiore, more hooked, more barbed, more likely to catch something? Or involantiore, from in wallo, translated in the Oxford Latin Dictionary, as to swoop down on in order to steal. Or could it just be waraciore and greedy in a different way from the way in which the son's arse is greedy? Or rapaciore, kind of greedy again, really, in a different sort of way. So there, you have to think about translation and meaning in trying to make a textual decision. Itis, this sort of why don't you both go off into exile question, doesn't have a word for both, but has a plural you. So perhaps do we add both to the translation to show that? And then malas. That's just the Latin word for bad, as practically everybody knows. But what a lot of people don't know until a much later stage is that it can be used in this very directed way as a sort of mild to moderate swearing sort of tone. There's an example in Catullus 64, which I've delighted in translating in my commentary, where Ariadne says to Theseus, who has abandoned her, or describes him as malos hic, for which the natural translation is this bastard. It's about that sort of level, and so, okay, bad shores, bloody shores, oh, it's not really going to work, is it? Fucking shores? What? Are we going to try and translate this whole why don't you just go in some other way? The problem is that if we sort of aim for go fuck yourselves, go get fucked, in this context, this brings in all kinds of fucking that isn't quite the same fucking that's being talked about in the poem and introduces stuff that goes beyond Catullus in a way that, you know, perhaps we might not want to go if we're thinking, what's in the Latin? Let's learn and appreciate the Latin, which is the context I was starting with. On the other hand, poor old nam, for, and quando quidem, since indeed, don't seem to fit any tone that we want for an English connective at all, and yet if my students were to leave them out, I would not be happy. And finally, this idea that the son can't sell his arse for an ass, this ass, this word for sort of a small coin that we all know from Catullus 5, where a lesbia is told that we're going to value the rumours of old men at a single ass. I challenge any English speaker who sort of thinks, oh, I'm going to leave it in as the Latin word in their translation, not to think I was just talking about an ass or an arse a moment ago when I was translating culo, and maybe this addition to Catullus is something you might feel a little happier with. The other thing about sort of translation and the way you do it as a student is that you tend to think of it in quite a prosaic sort of way, and in a way that's not wrong for this poem. It is chatty, it's enjambed. The rhythm, though very obvious, is very sort of flowing and easy, and the level of diction and other aspects of the style are, of course, fairly colloquial, fairly ordinary. But of course the challenge in teaching is to put it together again as poetry after we've pulled it apart, to make students see why it is still a poem, particularly when it isn't perhaps one of the most appealing poems they can easily fit into their story of Catullus, who they want Catullus to be. My second example is on the back page because it's longer. And this is from the poem that I work on, from Catullus 64. A long poem for Catullus, a very short mythological epic. I've included most, not all, of my draft commentary on this section on the other sheets, which you don't need to look at in great detail. This is a very, very different sort of poem, of course, in its epic hexameter meter, its genre more generally, its level of diction. Much could be said about its style, but one thing that is worth noticing in comparison is that the lines tend to be end-stopped. Every line presents itself. I've read a description of the lines in this poem presenting themselves for inspection, saying, am I not beautiful? This particular passage comes quite late on in the poem which, among other things, is the story of the marriage of Peleus and Thetis, the parents of Achilles. Scene is set at their wedding, and their wedding hymn is being sung by the Fates, and therefore it is prophetic. But they open their hymn song not with prophecy, but with some bits and pieces that are more to do with the sort of thing you might more normally say at a wedding. Now, and I'm not going to read this one, by the way, because it would take too long. The commentary, one of the things I noticed as I just picked up this piece, having decided to talk about this passage, was how often in the commentary I use glosses. I start a note by translating just that word into English for all sorts of reasons. And so the main point of giving you so much of the commentary is so you can see quite how many circles I ended up drawing around places where I put in little bits of translation. So sometimes just a word itself, but often I'm talking about that word in its immediate context, and it's not so much a translation as a way of capturing what it refers to. Are there different ways of taking it with other words in its vicinity? What are its various connotations, levels of meaning? Commentaries can suggestively offer options, a bit like my mind map, different bits of a potential translation and interpretation. Commentaries can open up or shut down possibilities of meaning, and mine is a fairly open one and tends to open up, but when it does shut down possibilities, it will often do so via having offered a translation interpretation that it then rejects. And that means that little moment of translation of interpretation remains on some level as some kind of possibility, even a rejected one, for the reader of the commentary and the poem. So what do the Fates say here? Well, they also open this address with O, but that's fine in this genre. I think we're going to leave that one in. My first question that I discuss in the commentary is in this first line, which means something like increasing, person who is increasing exceptional glory, decus eximium, by great deeds. Is that just glory? Why has he got this glory? You can sometimes use decus to mean beauty. Is that appropriate in this context? Virtutibus, which is a word, virtutes, that comes back a few times in this poem, can mean heroic deeds, but it can mean more generally virtues, heroic qualities. And this becomes a problem later in the Fates song, where the predicted son of this marriage is going to show his virtutes by murdering, well, killing in battle, but it's described in murderous terms, an awfully large number of people, and then by having a beautiful girl's throat cut over his grave. Can we point ahead to that at this point? Is it deeds or is it virtues? In the next line, 324, my note on tutamen begins with safeguard, to point out to my readers, look, have you noticed? This is a noun made from a verb that means to keep safe. But the more interesting thing about that line is that it's the most famous piece of textual criticism, line on which textual criticism has been practiced in the whole of Catullus, because A. E. Housman, about whom we're always happy to hear stories, sorted it out by moving a comma. It used to say, it used to mean, Ematiae tutamen opis carissime nato, which you see in the handwritten bit, safeguard of the power of Emathia or wealth of Emathia, most dear to your son. I mean, implied your son, who else's son would it be? But his son hasn't been born yet. This is his wedding. The son hasn't been mentioned yet, though he will be. Maybe change carissime to clarissime and reinterpret nato, most famous because of your son. Or do what Housman did and think, well, there's too little in the second half of the line, too much in the first half of the line. Move the comma. Put in a capital letter, which the Romans didn't have, of course. Safeguard of Emathia makes a great deal of sense by itself. Sense. Opis, capitalised, becomes the genitive of Ops, the name of Rhea, as we call her in Greek, the mother of Zeus, Jupiter. That's who the son is. And Peleus, like all heroes, is dear to Zeus, dear to Jupiter. Lighta luce, in the next line. Happy light. No, this looks like looks equals day. But that's the way that the understanding, the translation has gone and crossed out light and put day. But there's still light hovering in the background as the bright loveliness of this wedding, which the Fates follow. This is a song which the Fates sing as they spin fate, and they have this recurrent refrain addressed to their spindles, as you see. But because of the way that accusatives and nominatives work in Latin, that quae fata sequuntur could mean that the Fates, the utterance perhaps, follows the spindles, the threads running on, or it could mean that the threads drawn on by the spindles follow the fates, the utterances, the spinning rather, and the speaking are clearly the same thing and are both fate, and that ambiguity very difficult to capture in English translation because of the problems of syntax and word order when compared to Latin is very much present, and I can talk about it in my commentary. There are lots more points there that I could discuss, but I did particularly want to mention something slightly different, which is line 332, as a very interesting line for how the style of this poem works. That second stanza has sort of moved inwards from the arrival of the evening star that sort of signals the approach of the wedding night, and basically, in increasingly specific language, sort of glimpses the inside of the marital bed itself. And line 332, the final glimpse of that, very intimately, very close up, means laying under substernens, smooth arms, strong neck. Her smooth arms, your, the husband's, strong neck. This line has five words in it. This is something that happens in this poem a great deal. Using the building blocks of Latin without all the sort of glue that we need in English of prepositions and so forth to produce a elegant, self-standing, presenting itself for inspection kind of line. And one particularly favoured kind, like this, has one verb, two adjectives and two nouns. One adjective agreeing with each noun. The most famous version is something called the golden line where the verb comes in the middle, but I think this kind is even more interesting because it keeps coming back. And I've given you the bottom of the page every time it comes back. Every single time, the verb is a present participle. There's then a direct object, which is the adjective at the beginning of the line, and the noun one space in from the end. It's usually neuter plural. And obviously there are sort of metrical reasons why those words find themselves in that part of the line, and it's not a coincidence that vestigia comes up three times, once meaning steps, once meaning feet, and once meaning scars. I can tell you why if you need to know. And then the next adjective and noun are either an indirect object in the dative, or a dependent genitive, or a related ablative of some kind. And this affects how we have to translate them into English, because the preposition that we use to cover the meaning of the dative, the genitive, or the ablative will vary, even if we try to be very literal and maintain the parallelism between all the lines of the shape as much as we can otherwise. And the point of this is that each of these lines means something in its own context. It's always this end stop line using a participial phrase to add a detail, an extra active action to something that might otherwise have been complete in itself. but this very shape is one of the many ways in which in this poem you always feel that the text is folding back on itself, like a stitch catching another bit of the fabric. And finally, the last sort of stanza of the three I've quoted here from the Fates uses relationships and balance among the building blocks of the Latin to talk about this relationship, this idealised relationship between the couple getting married. No house ever sheltered such loves. And then the love becomes the object with the next iteration of nullus, the word for no. No love. Understand ever, I suppose, from the first line, joined lovers in such a bond, so such as moved to the ablative rather than the direct object. Qualis adest fetidi, as is present to fetis, as what? The love, perhaps? No, there is also going to be a noun, as the harmony that is present to both fetis and peleus. And that noun looks as if it then picks up foidus, the word for bond. Now, this word foidus, a student said to me yesterday, well, it's very difficult not to think of it as a treaty. Treaty is one of the things that it can mean. It's basically a word from sort of public life used in different social contexts, and you might translate it in different ways. So that's what I do in the commentary. I sort of say, well, basically a pact, but it could be a treaty in sort of politics, or a bond of friendship, which can be a contract in commerce. And it's particularly important for trying to understand how Catullus uses concepts from overlapping areas of social interaction, from politics, from ritualised friendship, ultimately from marriage, to talk about his relationship with Lesbia, to whom he is not married. And so finally, going back onto page one, with my third example, I want to look at a poem which has a huge number of points of connection in its Latin with that last stanza that I discussed of the Fates song, including the words unquam ever and foedere, foedus, ban, bond, pact, in the ablative, at the same respective points in the hexameter line, but here they've been brought together consecutively. This is from the last part of Catullus's corpus, written in elegiac couplets. The first line of each elegiac couplet is a hexameter, the same as we used continuously in poem 64. It's an epigram, it's epigrammatic. Epigrams and, in Latin, elegiac couplets use pairs and parallelism more than any other kind of Latin poetry. And the issues for translation here are less a vocabulary, which is quite simple in this poem, largely, than of finding ways of capturing this style. Are there ways of pointing up all the parallelisms, making the building blocks clear without including too many extra words that we sort of need in English, while still writing English that sounds, on the surface, as straightforward an utterance as the Latin does? In a moment, I'm going to read the poem in Latin to try and give you an impression of how straightforward and how naturally expressed it is. The word order, even, is basically natural and what one might expect in prose, with, of course, a couple of interesting exceptions. Where the adverb meaning truly comes after amartam, loved, when an ordinary Latin word order would probably expect it before, and it's enjambed at the beginning of the second line with a pause afterwards, which is obviously an emphatic place in Latin as in other languages. Which makes it float freer a bit. Maybe it could go with dicere. Is she loved truly, or does she say truly that she's loved? And the two mea are late, mea, mine. The one in line two that connects to lesbia, she's normally, and she is in other poems, mea lesbia. And in the fourth line, ex parte mea is an expression on my part, and it's interrupted by reperta, found, so that the two instances of meest, meast, elided into each other, can parallel each other at the ends of the two shorter lines, at the ends of the two couplets. But that also makes us think very hard about the issues of possession and subjectivity that are under discussion in this poem. And that's the most important point of all, because the last line includes in amore tuo, in your love. In Latin, we like to talk about subjective or objective genitives, and here we have what is equivalently either a subjective or an objective possessive adjective, tuo, your. In your love can mean in love coming from you, subjective, or in love of you coming from somewhere else, in this case me, objective. So again, I sort of explain in my translation that is by no means a translation to be read in English, but just a translation to help me, help anybody I'm teaching with the Latin. I explain by giving a sort of alternative translation, and I sort of always want both of them to be there in any translation of the whole poem. Tuo is, briefly, ambiguous. And then ex parte mea tells us that in the speaker's opinion, tuo was objective, and it was in love of you on my side. The entire emphatic statement of the poem, despite the parallelism, despite foedere, despite the link to the perfect mutual love of Peleus and Thetis, is being made about the speaker's own emotion. And we may wonder what he really knows about the emotions of the two of the poem, the second person in the second couplet, who was a third person lesbian in the first two lines, what he knows about her at all. Nulla potest mulier, tantum se dicere amatum vere, quanta me lesbia amata meast. Nulla fides ullo fuit umquam foedere tanta, quanta in amore tuo ex parte reperta meast. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you very much. That was really interesting and also helpful at the beginning. Any quick questions or clarification for Gail? Like stuff that isn't quite across?
Anything I went over too quickly, Latin wise.
And if not, we'll move straight on to Nicola.
All right, thank you very much. My presentation will be less linguistic and more probably personal, although I will try to tell you something about Catullus myself, and what I will be saying about Catullus comes from my experience as a translator and the one who actually meant to say and put something nice in Italian. Well, translating from Latin into Italian is a very peculiar experience because Italian is the very one of the very languages that derive from Latin. So it's kind of, you know, very incestuous to do that. You still want to sound foreign, but you can't completely be foreign because you're in the end still working in a direct emanation of the Latin you are translating from. But I won't go into that, although that's speculatively quite tempting and intriguing. I'd always wanted to translate Catullus because Catullus to me as a classicist, as a student of Latin, had always encapsulated the beauty and the great power of the Latin language ever since I started my studies in Latin when I was 14. You know, in Italian there's this very strong institution which is called the Liceo Classical High School, and you know, you study Latin very, very deeply and massively, so do you with Greek. And I do remember that my grammar had a lot of Catullus in it, in the examples. So to me, Catullus has always been, you know, something familiar. But I grew with the idea that Catullus could not be translated because he was too perfect, he was too much of a formalist, and very, very spare, very hard to put... to put into Italian, you know, very hard to make grow into, you know, what his Latin would in the end actually become centuries later. But there's always a good reason. I mean, translations that can be done are ultimately translations that you don't find an opportunity to do. And over the years, I became more and more interested in Catullus. And at one point, I found an opportunity to translate Catullus, and that was the awful financial times we live in. There we have a young man who is absolutely dissatisfied with his days, with the political regime, with the ugly language that he is surrounded by, and who, I still say, a young man, and who... wants to respond and react to decay by producing something beautiful, linguistically. So I said, that's exactly what I want to do. That's me. And let's try to translate Catullus, try to understand what he did, and try to find a good way to do it in Italian. Translating Catullus in Italian also implied not just coming to terms with our progenitor language, Latin, but also with famous translations of Catullus in Italian. And there are at least two which I definitely had to come to terms with, while not, you know, feeling any need to keep them on my desk while during my translation. But still, I knew those translations, and I had to outdo them, or there was no point to even try to start translating Catullus. One is from the 40s, and it's the best Catullus available in Italian as far as I know. Before my translation, of course. And this is Quasimodo. Quasimodo, famous poet, especially for his translations from the Greek. He got the Nobel Prize as a poet, but indeed he's very much neglected today as a poet. He's mostly remembered for his beautiful translations from the Greek. His Catullus is not that famous anymore. I was lucky because his Catullus is incomplete. It's just, you know, an anthology of passages. And plus, his Catullus is quite free, meaning that he wouldn't respect the line division in the original. And I definitely wanted to respect the partition of the original texts in Italian. Then there's a much later translation from the late 60s. Indeed, 69, by Juan Guido Ceronetti. That's a popular translation. It circulated a lot, and I myself received it when I was 15, and I've got my Ceronetti. I was still quite ignorant of Latin to understand the awful things that Ceronetti did in his translation, but still that translation, you know, meant something to me and indeed made me feel closer to Catullus. Very free rendition, no respect for the original, no, I mean, lots of additions, no apparent formalism in the Italian. So what did I want to do? I wanted to do an Italian Catullus, which would still be perceived as a Latin Catullus. My translation should be in metrical forms. I didn't mean to. There's also a very long tradition of in Italy of metrica barbara, that is, of reproductions, I mean, tentative reproductions of quantitative meters. But I wouldn't go there. I mean, I tried them some time ago with Virgil, but those are very private experiments, which I do keep in my drawers. You know, the Hendecasyllable poems of the first section could be easily transferred into Hendecasyllables in Italian. The more problems arose with the longer poems, because they are very narrative, and in Italian there's no there's not a long enough line that can accommodate what the hexameter of Catullus and also of Virgil does accommodate. But the epigrams were quite easy, because I could render the hexameter with a double settenario, that is 14 lines, very very Italian, it sounds good, and the pentameter with a hendecasyllable. So there were other possibilities for other compositions, and I did find also alternative solutions. This gives you a sense not just of mechanical kind of a reproduction of patterns, but that made me feel very responsible for the translation. I should do my best to get the best translation within those constraints. I wanted to give myself constraints. That would be the best way for me to commit myself with a good translation. So I wanted to write my Italian. I mean, I also write poetry, and some of you know it probably, and they know that I like experimenting with meters. I'm quite comfortable with also ancient metrics I compose in Latin and ancient Greek too. But this was not meant to be anything of the sort. I just wanted to make my Italian sound foreign to myself. And the only way to do that was to gag myself almost with these metrical constraints, while still, of course, attempting to sound as natural as possible without sounding crazily contrived and artsy, which, of course, I was not pursuing. It was a great experience. It was very healthy. It gave me a sense of measure. It gave me also an easy way to assess whether my translation was working or not working. But I'm not going to insist on that. I just want to say that Catullus, as Gail was reminding us, is a very varied poet, and I realized that he was a much better poet than I knew. He does a lot. He does a lot with little, because in the end this is quite a limited corpus. We know that a lot. Some Catullus was lost, indeed. He's not always impeccable, as I thought he was, actually, technically. For example, his hexameters are often... he's not Virgil yet, but they have fillers. He beats around the bush sometimes. Even the beginning, I don't know what you think, Gail, we can speak about this, but even the start of 64 is quite, you know, uncomfortable. He's obviously trying to find a grand beginning, but then when you have to translate it, you realize that there's too much going on there. And he gets better, you know, later in the poem, when he becomes more narrative, when he relaxes, probably. Well, that's another important thing that translators have got to learn how to do. There was this huge landscape of metrical possibilities, of themes. But the more I found my Catullus, the Catullus I grew to learn more in detail, the more I learned he was a grander poet than I knew, the more unity I also found. And I realized that no matter how much you find in him, there are probably one or two unifying metaphors underjacent, so you know, that lie beneath the surface, from which everything else springs. So this poet speaks of sex, he speaks of love, he speaks of politics, there's a lot on the empire, there's a lot on friends, there's a lot on literature, there's a lot on himself also as a traveler. There's his private life, there's his woman, there's his boyfriend or boyfriends. There are others who get married, there's mythology. There's more. But all of these seemed, there's contemporaneity and there's past, there's mythology, there's reality, there's imagination, there's a lot. But all of these differences, to me, ultimately, are traceable back to one very important paradigm, that of separation. Separation is a very important theme, and maybe the leading theme in the book, as far as I can tell, and you find it in many different guises. And these guises are so differentiated and so apparently metamorphosed that you hardly recognize them as deriving from that one original metaphor. So you will have death as separation again. You will have theft, separation and deprivation. He often complains about robberies he is a victim of. They take away his handkerchief, they take away his tablets, they take away his girlfriend, they take away his boyfriend, they take away money from him, they ask him to give money, and he doesn't. He's deprived of whatever wealth he might have had during his Eastern travels. Expenses, financial loss also are obviously apparent. Betrayal, losing friends, that appears too. Departures. There's a lot of traveling here. Even there where you seem to think that the theme would be, the prominent theme would be another. For example, let's take poem 63. This is one of the learned longer poems. It's a fantastic poem. It's the ideological pivot of Catullus's imagination, and that's the account of a castration, of a self-castration, of a self-emasculation. Attis cutting off his penis and realizing then, you know, what an amazing loss he has inflicted upon himself. Now, the deprivation, the theme of deprivation is most tellingly encapsulated by the scene of this castration, which I then, you know, as a translator and reader of Catullus, found akin to other forms of cutting. For example, there's a concubinus at some point, the boy, the groom has had a lot of fun with till he gets married, who has to have his hair cut because that's a coming of age and he needs to become a man himself. So when the master becomes a married man, he has to say goodbye to the master. It's a very moving passage. He has to say goodbye to man himself and have his hair cut and become basically heterosexual, although this category, of course, wouldn't work within Catullus's sexuality. There's another famous poem, 66, in which the theme of haircutting becomes grandiose, and that's Berenice's hair, la chioma di Berenice in Italian. This is a famous poem also because it's a translation or an adaptation from Callimachus, and I want to conclude on this poem and tell you something about it. The poem as I said, is a translation, and just like other things in Catullus, famously he translated Sappho and the famous poem on jealousy. But this poem, to me, first of all, it was one of the most difficult things to translate, and I really, you know, did my best to render it as grand as it is in the original, forcing my Italian to do funny things, but. I needed the sublime, but not a comical sublime, not a baroque, a pompous style. I thought that this poem indeed was a tragic poem, although it sometimes, and you can confirm this, it hasn't been read as such, because, come on, all this big deal about a lock of hair becoming a constellation, the Queen Berenice lost her hair, and this hair turned into a constellation. That's the myth as found in Callimachus. But if you realize that this separation, which the hair in the first person, in the first grammatical person, laments, is to be inscribed within this much broader frame of losses, of deaths, of deprivations, of even castrations, you realize that this is a most symbolic an archetypal moment in the Libellus, no matter what the order of the poems might have been originally. When I say the Libellus, I say the imagination of the poet as an orchestrating force. Virgil liked very much one line of this translation of Catullus. The famous line in Catullus is "Invito regina tuo de vertice cessi." The translation is very easy. Unwilling, it's in the feminine because it's the comma, the hair that speaks. Unwilling, or queen, cessi, I left de tuo vertice, from your head. Now, this very line would be repeated by Aeneas in Book 6 of the Aeneid, when he meets Dido, who's committed suicide for him. We know the famous, beautiful passage where Dido refuses to talk to Aeneas. She's still angry, and she'll remain angry for eternity. And Aeneas says, "My dear Regina, unwilling I left from your shore." Virgil just substitutes, replaces vertice with litore, the feminine with the masculine, because it's Aeneas who speaks, and therefore the agreement must be in the masculine, but otherwise it's exactly the same line. Now, most critics I've come across have thought that there was irony here. Of course, nothing weird in finding the rephrasing of a predecessor in a Latin poet. Latin poets do that. And actually, it's institutional to imitate a predecessor, to allude. But why? How in the world could Virgil have his Aeneas allude to this worldly, mundane passage in a most tragic passage? He's not alluding to a worldly or mundane passage. Virgil knew that the comma, Berenice's, is a tragic poem. That's my point. And I'm so sure about that, and Virgil is totally on my side, because that very passage, or in Catullus, resurfaces a few books later in Book 12, which is the concluding book of the poem, in which Juno is approached by Jove, who tells her, "Look, now it's over. You've got to come to terms with what the fate wants. You cannot postpone the victory of the Trojans will become the Romans anymore. Turnus, your favorite, your protégé, will have to die. Leave. It's over." Catullus surfaces again, and she indeed will say, "Jupiter et Turnum," second passage in my handout, second line, "Jupiter, O Jove, et Turnum," I'm not reading in metrics, "and et Terras, invita reliqui." You see, you have the same invita, it's not in the same metrical position, so it's hard to detect as alluding to Catullus. But of course, when I came across this passage, I jumped and I said, there is my beloved in vita or in vita. And then I said, but there's Jupiter there, but Jupiter is also in Catullus. Go back to the preceding passage. And then I say, oh, but Digna, Digna is also in Catullus. And oh my God, adiuro, caput, cedo, in the present. So you see that Catullus is, that Catullus has kind of resurfaced and has been recombined as almost a subconscious remembrance in one of the most pivotal passages of the poem, that in which Juno has got to let things go. And working as a translator teaches you such things, because you are constantly, or as a commentator probably, also you have to, you know, also see things within a system. That's what I learned during my Catullus. I'm sure that if it started all over, the translation would be completely different. I would see other things. But I was very grateful to the company Catullus kept me for 2 years, not until very long ago, because the translation came out this year. It was completed a couple of years ago, and then I revised it. And so I learned how to see motifs. I learned how to see hidden kinships between far and distant and apparently irreconcilable elements within the book. And then, you know, some of these discoveries make you feel you've been in company with those great ancients, not for nothing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Natalia. Any quick points of clarification?
Joe. Thank you, Matthew. Well, I'm also going to present quite a personal view of translating Catullus. And there's a little bit of Gail's sort of scholarship, but mostly it's a fairly light-hearted presentation, as we're quite late now on a Friday evening. Now, when Matthew mentioned to me that he wanted to entitle this evening's proceedings Unbuttoning Catullus, I thought that sounded very, very apt indeed, because it's a rather naughty, kind of titillating title. It has this aura of sexual teasing, but also sexual menace. And I think, and we can all agree, that sort of sums Catullus up. So yes, it seemed very, very apt. And the image that came into my head sort of straight away, I don't know whether any of you remember when you were children, you used to get those paper cut-out dolls, and you cut out the doll and then cut out the little costumes, you'd have little folds and fold them over. And it seemed to me that in a way that's often what we're doing when we're translating classical poetry, is we're sort of stripping poets down to their underwear and putting new costumes on them. But those costumes are often really quite temporary, because somebody else comes along, new ideas come along, new scholarship, and we all move on again. Now, the other thing that struck me was actually we're talking, in my case, about an issue of dressing up as, which is transvesticism, because I was a woman translator translating this most male of poets. And it's quite interesting that actually we've got two women sitting here today, because quite often women have been rather loath to engage with Catullus. And it is hardly surprising when Catullus describes his own lover, Lesbia, as a ball breaker, and I've just put this little extract here from poem 11. He says of Lesbia, loving none, having all, over and over, just breaking their balls. And when we look at the history of Catullus in translation, there are very, very few women in that history. Julia Hay Gaser's anthology Catullus in English for Penguin, which came out, I think, in about 2001, had over 100 translators. Only 5 were women, and I think there were 2 more imitators in that. And the first sort of women translator that she had was Mary Stuart in 1915. And actually, in many ways, that's quite, you know, quite an early date. As I say, it's not surprising. We think about what Catullus says in poem 97, which is even worse, what he says in Lesbia. And he says, as for the women, let's try to define them. They would lick the arse of diarrhoeaed hangmen. It's not exactly the sort of material that it's terribly easy sometimes to engage with. And I think what's interesting is one, some of the most famous engagements of women with Catullus has been in fiction. For example, Benita Kane Jarrow, 1988 novel The Key, and also Helen Dunmore's 2008 novel Counting the Stars. And they portray Catullus very much as a sort of poetic, doomed lover. It's very much the Catullus of the love poems, and avoiding the Catullus, or sort of neglecting to look at the Catullus of the wider corpus, which is sort of is much, sometimes, as I'm going to look at, much harder for women to engage with. Now, I'll just put this little one from Dorothy Parker, which is in the Julia Hagesa, because she took a very much more robust view of Catullus, which is quite fun here. She speaks as Lesbia, and this is what she has Lesbia say back to Catullus. "It's just the same, a quarrel or a kiss is but a tune to play upon his pipe. He's always hymning that or wailing this. Myself, I much prefer the business type." Now, for myself, approaching Catullus, I found in many ways the love poems were quite difficult, because what you're doing is you're that they are sort of as a text. They are treating women as an object, and the aim of the text is to seduce that love object. So in a way, it's quite hard as a woman to enter into it. I found it particularly difficult with my first example here, which is Catullus' poem 51, which is a translation of Sappho 31. And I had previously translated Sappho, so I was then sort of looking at the poem third hand. And Sappho's poem, as some of you may or may not know, is about the sort of sensation of the physical sensation. It's a very sensual poem of the moment that the lover sees the beloved, and it's about women. And there are no men. Well, there's one man in it, but only very briefly. It's about the sort of emotional closed world women in ancient Greek, and it's almost certainly homosexual, it's lesbian. So, as I say here, how could a male, this is from piecing together the fragments, how could a male heterosexual version of female homosexual desire be rendered into English by a woman translator who had previously worked on Sappho's original? Now, the first decision that I made when I came to Catullus 51 was to treat it as an entirely new poem, in many ways to sort of try and put everything behind, because it very much is, I'm sure we'll agree, it's a poem in its own right. It's one of the first translations that we know, and it's very, very interesting from that point of view. And we could have another whole seminar tonight discussing the similarities between Catullus's poem and Sappho's and the differences as well. But I think you have to treat it as a new poem. But at the same time, I thought that as I say, I was approaching it third hand, and I wanted to underline that somehow in my translation, very subtly. I wanted to somehow try and sort of signify that that's what was going on. And for working in my favour was the fact that Catullus's wit and irony in the poem. He was writing the poem for a very literate, educated audience, who would know exactly the sort of transformations that he had enacted on Sappho. They knew the original. So to them, there were loads of in-jokes here. They knew exactly what he had done with it, whereas when we read it, that might not necessarily be the case. So I'd just like to read the poem for you. And I have to say that, for me, Catullus's persona here has always been more, it always seems to me to be more one of self-mockery. It's more witty and teasing, rather than, again, the doomed lover that we might see in the novels that I mentioned. This is Catullus 51. "That man to me seems the equal of a god. That man, dare I say, surpasses the divine. The one who sits by you, who time after time looks on you, who hears you as you laugh so sweetly, while I'm in hell, senses shredded, torn apart. For when I see you there, Lesbia, there's nothing left of me, no voice to speak of. As my tongue is numbed, my lips struck dumb, pale fire trickles down my limbs, my ears resound, ring-ting with their own thunder. and my eyes are covered by these dark nights, twin. Now, what I wanted to do was to create, as I say, to create a light, knowing mood in this translation with the use of these teasing internal rhymes to try and get the musicality of the Greek, but all, of the Latin, but also of Sappho's Greek, which is underlying Catullus's poem, like a palimpsest. I also use full and full and half end rhyme, which in English is a time-honoured way of suggesting humour and a slightly ironic approach. And so, as I say, my Catullus, and Nicola was talking about his Catullus, I think it's the thing we say, my Catullus, is rather self-mocking, he's teasing, he's playful, and he's less threatening. And I think, in a way, he might even say he's slightly demasculized even, in my versions, and I'm going to explore this further. And what I found was, especially when I looked back at the translations to write about them for piecing together the fragments, so many of these processes were almost subconscious at the time, I think. What I found was that this kind of ironic semantic tone that I'd adopted for the translation of Sappho carried through into other poems and translations that I'd done of Catullus. And I want to look now at Catullus 8, which John Godwin summed up rather nicely as a concise study in melancholia and repressed wishes. I mean, one could, if one was being unkind, say it's almost a bit like a pity party. It's a very, it seems on the surface anyway, to be a fairly self-pitying poem. And it's written in these beautiful, limping iambics, and again, it has this musicality, this sort of music of misery running right through it. But I see now when I was translating it, again, I was subverting it slightly, and that my Catullus has his tongue really rather slightly in his cheek. This is poem 8. You wretch, Catullus, just stop this faking, and write off now what is faded, failing. Once you had dazzling sunshine, your skies glowed. Days you'd go anywhere, on her say so. The one you loved, as no other will be. There was time for laughter, to joke, to tease, when you said yes, and she didn't say no. Oh, you had dazzling sunshine, your skies glowed. Now she demurs, so you two must abjure. Don't play the fool, or follow her allure. But see it through, hold on, hold out, harden. Farewell, girl, Catullus plays the hard man. Won't persist if you resist. Beg where shunned, though you'll regret it when you're begged by none. You witch, what life now do you think you've earned? Who will possess you? Whose love will you see? Who'll obsess you? Whose will you seem to be? Who will caress you? Whose lips will you burn? Come on now, Catullus, hold out, harden. Now, I put the Latin there, I'm not going to go into it, but it's fairly clear, my translation shadows Catullus's semantics, but it's not necessarily literal. And I think it's more what Octavio Paz calls a mimetic translation, is how I would describe it, which is one that changes the text to reproduce the effect, but not too much, just a little bit here and there. And again, it's quite a playful translation. It's got these internal rhymes and teasing semantics. And I noticed when I came to look at it again that when I was translating the verb obduro, which is to harden or to endure, which I've underlined it in the Latin, Catullus repeats three times in the poem like a leitmotif. But I've almost added, I think, a little bit of a sexual pun there, very definitely, if not even. And I think, well, is it a pun in Latin? Well, I don't know, possibly. If you look in the dictionary, they make no mention of this, but then that's hardly surprising because the Latin dictionary never makes any mention of anything sexual. If you look in the kind of Bible of Latin sexual vocabulary, which is J.N. Adams' study, the Latin sexual vocabulary, he doesn't mention obduro. It doesn't mean to say that it isn't a pun. But I think, you know, as a translator, sometimes these things, you just can't resist them. I don't know. We might talk about this
like
later.
Your ass and asses. Yeah. Your ass is not worth an ass. That's great.
Exactly. This is what happens, I think. Mm. Now, when we move on to the wider poems, as I say, the wider poems outside the love poems, which are the sort of poems that you might have done you know, for GCSE or first year at university, we can see there are more issues for women translators. There's the scatological Roman street slang, the sexually violent imagery, and the foul-mouthed invectives against female and indeed male lovers. Now, I wanted to take as an example here Catullus 41. Now, in this poem, Catullus is complaining because he's been overcharged by, as he puts it, a not very attractive prostitute. You know, it's a complete nerve of hers because she's not even very attractive. How dare she? And the poem turns on a pun in Latin I've underlined it in the last line on the word on the Latin ace, which is literally bronze, but in Latin could mean either a mirror or coinage. And I suppose it's a bit like English brass, except we would say brass mirror, but we would use brass as money. What was I going to say before I read this to you? Oh, yes. Now, when I was working on my translation, if you look at line 4, I was looking for a rhyme for feeling in line 4. I was thinking about, you know, I'd already got that line. I thought, what can I rhyme with this? And then I came up with the idea of ceiling. And a ceiling, I was thinking, was also a financial pun. You know, you have a financial ceiling. And that led me on to Mae West. In this kind of bizarre way when you're sort of working away in a text that your mind goes off in all sorts of directions. And Mae West's famous riposte when she was asked in an interview why she had so many mirrors on her bedroom ceiling, and she replied, well, I can't do the accent, I like to see how I'm doing. So I thought, well, this is nice, because we can take this then away from this sort of male sort of sexual invective to sort of female confidence and insouciance, and sort of take it from the gutter to the glamour almost of Mae West. Anyway, I'll read you this translation. Catullus, poem 41. Ammiana, the girl who goes and goes, had the nerve to charge me 10,000 whole. You know, the girl with the big beaky nose, the one that bankrupt mama is feeling. Call in her next of kin, put her in care. Send out for her friends and physicians. For the girl is insane. She's not all there. She needs a brass mirror above the bed so she can reflect on her own ceiling. And again, you can see that we're back in the idea of a mimetic translation rather than very definitely a literal one. Now, jokes, of course, are the hardest things for any translator to work with, whether they're working with contemporary literature or ancient literature, and it's particularly difficult when you're looking at jokes from a long dead language in a long dead culture, and you can't phone up the poet like you can if they're a contemporary poet and say, what does this joke mean, and they can explain it to you. So they are really, really hard, and they're very, very it's very, very easy to get tripped up by them, I think. I mean, I'm always reminded of in English of the verb block, which in the 40s used to mean having sex, but now, of course, that's completely lost. When my husband started work as a journalist, he got a list of all the words you couldn't use, and this said block as a verb. And of course, you know, he was 21 or something. Nobody understood this. Well, why can't we use the word block? And the editor said, oh, well, haven't you heard this joke and that joke? You know, all these very old 40s jokes. And you're thinking, well, no. So the language goes out, the euphemisms, you know, the jokes just go out of fashion so very, very quickly. Now, and coming back, going back in time to Catullus, I'm just want to look at Catullus 32, which is a case in point. Now, Catullus 32 is about, Catullus wants to have an afternoon assignation with one Ipsatilla. And it's a poem packed full of innuendo and sexual puns, and some of them, or quite a lot of them, are very, very culturally specific to Rome, so that makes it even more difficult for us as a translator. If we look in line 5, we have the tabellam. The tabella were the Roman door shutter flaps. I don't know whether do they still have this, is it still the same word? I mean, there must be the sort of little bits that flap back.
In some southern cities, yeah.
So obviously in English this means very, very little to us. Then we have here a nexative element, the verb obserere, obsero or obserere, which means to block in Latin. And it could possibly be a pun here, I think, on obserere, which means to sew, which has sexual connotations. So we see there could be all sorts of innuendos going on here. In this particular poem, I'm always reminded of Max Miller, the 1940s comedian, British comedian, who is also known as the Cheeky Chappie for his kind of very saucy jokes. And he always tells this joke. He used to tell this joke, and he got him banned by the BBC, where he said he met a buxom, naked blonde, as they always are, in a high mountain pass. And he said, I didn't know whether to toss myself off or block her passage. And when we'll see in a minute, this is, always reminds me of this Catullan joke, because actually it's the same joke. Moving on through, we have fortutiones. I've underlined that as well. Now, this is a made-up word by Catullus. It's a new coinage, and it sounds very, very erudite and academic. But in fact, it's derived from the what we might call the low Latin word futuere, which is basically fuck. If we look it up in LSJ, the Latin dictionary, it's always defined as to have connection with a woman, which is kind of what we're dealing with when we look in the dictionary. And even J.N. Adams, when he is writing about it in his book, The Latin Sexual Vocabulary, he says it's the basic obscenity for the male part in sexual intercourse, which is, again, really nice and academic. So it sort of sounds like it's maybe, I say the word vanilla, that sounds awful, but it's kind of, it's not too bad, you know, it's not too bad a sort of word. Because obviously getting register when you're a translator is incredibly important. You need to know how bad is this word? You know, how much shock would it have given the reader? Would they have been quite used to seeing this word, or was it very, very shocking in this particular instance? Amy Richlin, in her study of sexual violence, sexual violence, I think, in Roman humour, she says, actually, no, it's a terrible word, because Cicero actually says it's a word that no one dare use. So again, we're sort of thinking, oh, I don't know, where are we with this? The poem ends with a pun centred around Prancis, which meant, Prancis literally means having breakfasted or lunched. And because soldiers always ate before they marched or they engaged in war, it came to mean ready for action. And of course, then it has a sexual connotation as well. Finally, Catullus is, you can see how you have to explain so much before you can even start reading the poem. Catullus is a satyr, meaning he's full, he's had his lunch and he's full, and he is per tando tunicamque palliumque. He's literally boring through tunic and cloak, and we can all imagine what that means. Okay. Now, I'm going to just read my translation of this and then say a few things about him. Please, please me, dear Ipsitilla, my own sweetness, my so clever. Invite me in for siesta, and I'll come, but at your leisure. Don't block your passage, fold down flaps, slip off out for other pleasures. Hold on, get set, let's fill the gap. 9 full time, full on, fuckings. Just say your game, just say you will. You see, I've eaten, had my fill, yet still my lunch box is bulging.
That's good.
Now you can see that I had a lot of fun there with the innuendo, and there's probably actually more innuendo in my English than there was.
You're worse than a man.
Exactly. Thank you. But when I look at it now, it's quite interesting. When you go back and you look at it, when I was writing piecing together the fragments, and I was re-looking back, you know, looking back at my work and thinking, what have I done? I always, quite often, thought, well, I could have done it better. I could have done it this way. And I think about the fuckings. I think maybe I should have gone for something a little bit more academic, like fuck-offs-ficatings or something that sounded a little bit more, got that tone that Catullus has, that this is a very erudite, you know, the mix of high and low. But actually, I didn't have enough syllable count in the line, and it would have made the line far too long. And I think, talking about register, I think we needed it. If you do that, then it doesn't sound so shocking, and I think it needs to sound shocking. So that's why I repeated it, and the fuck, and why I used the alliteration as well. Now, I just want to say a little bit about the lunchbox, because it's very high risk, I think, to use euphemisms in English. It's a risky thing when you're a translator to do this. And lunchbox actually first appeared in English in 1998 during the Linford Christie. You remember the Olympic sprinter Linford Christie brought a libel case against, I think it was the Daily Mirror, at the Old Bailey. And the presiding judge, this word came up, and the presiding judge, had this lovely name, Mr. Justice Popplewell, inquired in court. He said, "What is Linford's lunchbox?" And Linford Christie replied, "It's a reference to my genitals, my lord." And it then sort of went into English vernacular. And it's quite interesting because at the time, Jacob's Cream Crackers had an advert. I don't know whether any of you remember this. And they sort of plastered it all over the underground. And they said, you know, there was a new brand of cream cracker. And it said, "Every man's dream, an inch and a half extra in the lunchbox department." So I think they were bigger crackers than normal. Anyway, as I think what I did want to say, just to finish up on this poem, is that what's quite interesting, I think, when I look at what male translators do with this poem, is mine is far more far less threatening, because a lot of the male translators actually concentrate more on the potundo, on the penetration. So, for example, Peter Green has "I'm bursting up through undershirts and bedclothes." Peter Wigham has "I'm ripe for stuffing you." And Guy Lee, "I lie back after a long lunch, boring holes in tunic and cloak." And I think this is one way in which women, you know, can sort of approach Catullus, is that you actually make it, as I say, you kind of demasculise it a bit. You make it less threatening for yourself. And we were talking about Anne Carson. Matthew was reading out Anne Carson's quote. I think if you know Anne Carson's versions of Catullus, if you've ever seen them, what she does with Catullus is her solution is to break them down. I mean, the language just dissolves in English. She just breaks the text down completely, and so they're completely unrecognisable. And there's a New Zealand poet, Anna Jackson, who did a version of Catullus, which is called Catullus for Children. And actually, she rewrites Catullus as if they were playground songs, if they were children fighting in the playgrounds. And again, this is quite an interesting way, if you say, of demasculising Catullus. So, as I said in my introduction to Catullus' Poems of Love and Hate, I've written it down here, "Perhaps as a woman I could not take his belligerent posturing too seriously, but then neither one suspects did Catullus." Now, I'd just like to end with one last poem. I'd just like to say that this process was two-way. And just as I was infecting Catullus with my feminised responses, so he began to creep into my own work. And I'd like to end with a title poem here from Chasing Catullus, which is actually mostly quite a sombre book. But this title poem is called Chasing Catullus, obviously, and it owes, as you can see, a great deal to its namesake. Chasing Catullus. It's the rule of attraction, the corruption of texts, the way his corpus tastes of skin and sweat, that taint of decay, scent of cheated death. But then, I've always liked them old. Past hearts, lost minds, redundant souls. Just enough to get me fleshing ghosts, giving them tongue, jumping their bones. Yet sleep with the dead, and you'll wake with the worms. Stripped down, compressed, a little accusative, slightly stressed. To find the code you crack, the clause that breaks, is no longer subordinate. It's now your own. Thank you.